First of all, I thank Professor Hugh Price for inviting me to this wonderful workshop, and also Professor Anton Leist for all those kind arrangements. Since I'm not a native speaker of English, I have prepared a rather detailed PPT presentation, which I hope will help you better understand what I'm talking. Also, I have prepared printed copies of my PPT, which I believe is distributed. Okay, so let's begin. My presentation is entitled Pluralism, Representationalism, and Foundationalism. And it has an introduction and five sections. Okay, so first, introduction. I take that Hugh Price's main thesis in Naturalism Without Mirrors is the following. Everyone already recognizes that once we reject representationalism and accept pluralism about linguistic functions, we will be able to dissolve issues concerning the placement problems in contemporary metaphysics without giving up scientific naturalism. Just I'll skip what placement problems are, because everyone already knows that. Okay, here is outline of my presentation. It has five theses which roughly corresponds to each section. The section one, I think that Price's functional pluralism is committed to a version of linguistic foundationalism. So according to which, the linguistic framework of natural science and ultimately of physics plays a certain privileged role. And then I argue that Price's linguistic foundationalism commits him to a weak form of ontological foundationalism. But you might find this surprising, given Price's rejection of object naturalism. But I hope that it's not really surprising once I explain what I mean by ontological foundationalism. Okay, so what is weak form of ontological foundationalism? This is the view that all properties and facts posited by any legitimate linguistic framework are supervenient on the properties and facts posited by the framework of natural science. And then I would like to claim that ontological foundationalism, even in this weak sense, gives rise to the following two problems. So first, not all placement problems will go away. So this will be a serious problem for Price's purpose. And second, it might be that it's even inconsistent with Price's functional pluralism. Okay, and then I'd like to argue that Price cannot reject the weak form of ontological foundationalism unless he gives up scientific naturalism. So in sum, Price seems to fall into a dilemma. He must either embrace ontological foundationalism and thereby admit that there are some genuine placement problems, or he must reject ontological foundationalism, but then thereby give up scientific naturalism. Even in the form of subject naturalism. So at least that's what I will argue in my presentation. Okay, so let's go to the first section. I find that Price's naturalism really distinctive and very ingenious view, in the sense that, as far as I know, this is the only approach where it tries to combine a deflationary approach to placement problems with a scientific naturalism. So first, unlike most contemporary metaphysicians, Price holds the Wittgenstein and Carnapian view that issues concerning how to place apparently non-natural facts within the naturalistic framework are not genuine problems. So these issues must be dissolved rather than solved, right? But then, however, while typical Wittgensteinian philosophers reject scientific naturalism and embrace more liberal naturalism, such as Rorty and McDowell, Price remains firmly committed to scientific naturalism. So now I want to try to figure out how it is possible for him to combine these two features. So regarding one, Price defends a deflationary approach to placement problems due to his functional pluralism. I think this is already familiar to many of you. But regarding two, at least in my understanding, Price's commitments to scientific naturalism based on what I will call his linguistic foundations. All right, so first one. Here is Price's dissolution of placement problems through functional pluralism. It consists of seven steps. So step one, The placement problem arises from the approach of object naturalism, according to which all there exists is, in some important sense, the world studied by sciences. Step 2, but object naturalism presupposes representationalism, according to which the linguistic expressions about entities which give rise to various placement problems are all functioning the same way, namely by representing those entities. And step 3, in contrast with the approach of object naturalism, there is another naturalist approach which may be called subject naturalism. According to subject naturalism, we must study human beings as natural creatures who can perform various linguistic behaviors in a natural environment. And here comes the crucial step, step 4. From the viewpoint of subject naturalism, there may be a good scientific reason to deny representationalism, but there may be a good scientific reason to think that we human beings use linguistic expressions to perform a multiplicity of functions which are irreducible to one another. So here comes Price's functional pluralism. All right, so step 5. If linguistic expressions have a multiplicity of functions which are irreducible to one another, the so-called placement problems turn out to be committed to a kind of category mistakes, and accordingly do not even make sense. So the claims Price. And step 6 is also important for Price's purpose. So he claims that in our naturalist approach, we must give theoretical priority to the approach of subject naturalism. For the approach of object naturalism presupposes the unproven premise of representationalism, which may be undermined by the approach from subject naturalism. So final step, therefore, there may be a good reason to think that placement problems are pseudo problems from the very perspective of scientific naturalism. All right. Now here's an interesting point. So with the rejection of representationalism, Price rejects, along with Carnap and Quine, the popular view that natural science is completely non-perspective and provides a genuine representation of what the world is really like. So Price basically rejects metaphysical realism. But Price nevertheless insists on a version of scientific naturalism. So as I understand, this is because he takes it that the linguistic framework of natural science and ultimately of physics has a privileged status, and it is this framework from which we must investigate all other frameworks. So this is what I mean by linguistic foundations. Okay. Here is a quote from Price's book. He says, quote, "In my view, the explanation for the primacy of science lies in the fact that as functional pluralists, we speak from within the scientific framework, but about other frameworks. This gives the scientific framework a kind of perspectival primacy. Our viewpoint is internal to science, but external to morality, for example. It is a viewpoint which allows us to refer directly to the objects and properties countenanced by science, but not, given the Carnap thesis, to the objects countenanced by the moral stance," unquote. Okay, now I think that there is a serious question about this form of linguistic foundationism. So as Price himself makes it clear, if we reject representationalism, then it makes no sense to suppose that the framework of natural science provides the genuine representation of what the world is really like. But then, here is my question, why must we accept that the framework of natural science has even a perspectival privilege? Given anti-representationalism, why can't we think that every linguistic framework has a perspectival privilege from its own perspective? I think at some points, Price seems to argue that it is, but I think it is quite clear, at least to me, that it seems that Price gives a kind of absolute perspectival privilege to the natural science, although he might deny that. Namely, that it is supposedly the only framework from which we can legitimately investigate all other linguistic frameworks. Okay, now my question is why? You know that there are many philosophers, famous philosophers like Kant, Goodman, and Rorty, right? Who, all of them, reject representationalism, but who takes a different standpoint here. So for example, Kant gives priority to practical standpoint rather than theoretical standpoint. Goodman, for him, all possible world versions are on equal status. Rorty does not think that the framework of natural science is more fundamental or even have a, I mean, perspective or privilege. Okay, but then why? I mean, are we allowed to give a perspective or privilege to science according to Price? All right, as far as I can see, Price does not really give any explicit answer to this question. Well, I just learned today that he might appeal to the notion of E representation to answer this question. I don't think it will really work. Either the E representation might be too weak to give a required privilege, or it might be too strong to make it indistinguishable from just an outright representation. But I mean, let's leave that matter later. Okay, so he doesn't seem to give an explicit answer, but he does seem to give an implicit answer, which is similar to Quine's answer, I find. Okay, so here is possible answer, I mean, not from Price, but from Quine. Quine appeals to supervenience for this question, at least from my understanding. So as we will see later, I will give a definite, quote where Quine explicitly says so. As we'll see later, Quine's answer to the above challenge is as follows. Although we cannot suppose that the framework of natural science provides a completely non-perspectival and genuine representation of the world, we are still justified in giving a privileged role to this framework as long as we accept the supervenience thesis. Okay. All right, so what's the supervenience thesis? It's the thesis that all properties and facts posited by any legitimate linguistic framework are supervenient on the properties and facts posited by the framework of natural science and ultimately of physics. That is to say, for any legitimate linguistic framework, there can be no changes in the properties and facts posited by that framework unless there are some changes in the properties and facts posited by the framework of natural science and ultimately of physics. Okay. Now, I mean, it seems to me that Price does not deny the supervenience thesis. In fact, he seems to endorse it. So here are two quotes from Price's book. First one, quote, "It is natural to wonder," so here he is wondering about what's the distinction between, discourse pluralism, this is another term for functional pluralism, and what he calls additive monism, which is the view that where there are non-natural facts that are ontologically autonomous and legitimate, but still can be unified with natural facts. Okay, so here he considers the possibility that supervenience might do the trick, but then he claims that a little reflection shows that this won't do the job. And then he goes on to claim that it is far from clear that a pluralist need deny supervenience. It seems that supervenience is independent of the issue between discourse pluralism and additive monism. So here he seems to endorse the supervenience thesis, but then claims that it doesn't really have anything, doesn't really raise any difficulty for his functional pluralism. And then in another quote, he says that, quote, "I think a pluralist can account for the supervenient intuitions without allowing the identity claim," unquote. All right. Now, my claim is that once Price accepts the supervenient thesis, then he cannot but be committed to some form of ontological foundations in the following way. So if the supervenient thesis is correct, and accordingly, the linguistic framework of natural science and ultimately of physics is the only framework on which properties and facts of all other frameworks supervene, then there is sense in which properties and facts posited by the framework of natural science provide an ontological foundation for those posited by all the other frameworks. So you can see this in the slogan that no changes in any properties without changes in physical properties, right? In that sense, physical properties provide ontological foundations. Okay, so in this sense then, Price seems to be committed to ontological foundationism, even if he denies object naturalism. Okay, now, all of you know that there are varieties of supervenience. There is a weak supervenience, strong supervenience, and global supervenience. Well, in this presentation, I will assume by supervenience, global supervenience, that two worlds alike in every respect, if they are alike, exactly alike in physical respect. Well, I assume global supervenience simply because I find externalism about meaning and the mental plausible. And since, I mean, weak and strong supervenience focuses on individuals, I mean, focuses on the properties possessed by individuals, then if externalism is right, then weak supervenience and strong supervenience might be false. But, I mean, that failure would not give any threat for physicalism, as long as, I mean, we can accept global supervenience, which focuses on world rather than individuals. Okay. Now, here is a crucial thing, for Price's purpose. Supervenience is ontologically a very weak relation. So when M properties supervene on P properties, all it guarantees is that M properties cannot change without changes in properties. So in other words, all it guarantees is that M properties must co-vary with P properties. But it is widely agreed among metaphysicians that such covariance does not imply that M properties are identical with or reducible to or, surprisingly, even dependent on P properties. Well, it doesn't guarantee that M properties are even dependent on P properties because, well, two sets of properties, M and P, can covary by depending on the third set of properties, right? So think of Malebranchian occasionalism, or, I mean, Leibnizian pre-established harmony, where mental states do supervene on physical states, but they do not depend on physical states, right? They rather depend on, I mean, God's will. Okay, so here, now, I mean, Price seems to think as follows. Since supervenience is a very weak ontological relation, he seems to think that the acceptance of the supervenient thesis will not pose any real threat for its functional pluralism. Okay, so here is a quote from Price's book. But the attempt to extract reduction from supervenience is blocked by functional difference. The reduction does not go through, despite supervenience in the acknowledged sense, because the function of the supervening discourse is different from that of science, the supervening discourse. And this implies that the point works equally for a functional pluralist. Even if he affirms that the supervening discourse is descriptive, so long as there is a deeper sense in which the supervening and supervening discourses differ in function, unquote. But I think that once you accept the supervenient thesis, it will pose some real threats for functional pluralism. Okay, so actually I think there are two problems. The problem one, once you accept supervenience, then placement problems will persist. Well, although supervenience is a very weak relation, it does provide the following ontological restriction. So those who accept the supervenient thesis cannot admit the existence of the properties and facts which do not supervene on physical properties and facts. So if there are such properties and facts, that is to say, if there are such, I mean, properties and facts which do not supervene on physical properties and facts, then the relevant placement problems will inevitably arise. Okay, the question, but are there properties and facts which may not supervene on physical properties and facts? Yes, right? Because, first example, according to Quine, facts about meaning and intentional mental states do not supervene on physical facts. Number two, according to many philosophers, it is at least metaphysically possible that facts about qualia do not supervene on physical facts. So at least two M words, namely the world of meaning and the world of mental, I mean, to use Price's terminology, seem to be in threat. Okay, so here is Quine on the failure of supervenience between meaning facts and physical facts. As Quine himself emphasizes, his celebrated thesis of the indeterminacy of translation is not an epistemological thesis, right? Quine insists that the thesis is an ontological one, namely that there is simply no fact of the matter concerning which manner is correct. And here is my argument, or my claim. Quine's argument for this thesis is precisely based on the alleged failure of supervenience between facts of a meaning and physical facts. Okay, so here is a quote from Quine in his paper, Things and Their Place in Theories. He says, quote, "I have argued that two conflicting manuals of translation can both do justice to all dispositions to behavior, and that, in such a sense, there is no fact of the matter of which manual is right. The intended notion of matter of fact is not transcendental, or yet epistemological, not even a question of evidence. It is ontological, a question of reality, and to be taken naturalistically within our scientific theory of the world. So thus suppose, to make things vivid, that we are settling still for a physics of elementary particles and recognizing a dozen or so basic states and relations in which they may stand. Then, when I say there is no fact of the matter, as regards, say, the two rival manuals of translation, what I mean is that," so here comes the crucial part, "both manuals are comparable with all the same distributions of states and relations over elementary particles." Well, the last part is just the idea of supervenience, right? So all physical facts can remain the same, but it is still possible for two conflicting manuals to exist in such a way that, according to the first manual, it is a fact that gavagai, the term gavagai means rabbits, and according to the second manual, it is a fact that the term gavagai means undetached parts of rabbit, right? Okay, so this is the first problem I point out. So once you accept the supervenient thesis, then some placement problems will still remain. Okay, now I will go on to the second problem. So apart from the difficulty that the supervenient thesis leads to the persistence of placement problems, it seems to me that Price's functional pluralism is ultimately inconsistent with the supervenient thesis. I think that the best way of seeing this problem is by comparing Price's view with those of Carnap and Quine. If I am right, Carnap may be able to consistently deny the supervenient thesis, and Quine may be able to consistently accept it. But Price may not be able to consistently accept the supervenient thesis. Okay, so here's Carnap. I summarized Carnap's view in three theses. Here C stands for Carnap. So thing one, among ontological questions, we can make a sharp distinction between internal questions and external questions. C2, internal questions are genuinely cognitive questions, according to Carnap, but can be raised only within the relevant linguistic framework. C3, or less timid, external questions are purely pragmatic questions concerning whether or not to adopt the relevant linguistic framework. There are no genuinely cognitive external questions, and accordingly, there are no genuinely inter-framework ontological questions. So that's what Carnap claims. Okay, so how would Carnap say about the supervenient thesis? Well, since questions about the supervenience are not pragmatic questions about the adoption of linguistic frameworks, but belong to the category of inter-framework ontological questions. Supervenience is talking about properties in different frameworks, right? And it is ontological question, of course. So Carnap would conclude that they are not genuine questions, right? So therefore, Carnap would reject the supervenient thesis, not because it is false, but because it is one of those meaningless metaphysical statements, right? Okay, now what about Carnap? Here are three theses for Quine on ontological questions. So Q1, contrary to Carnap's claim, we cannot make a sharp distinction between internal questions and external questions. But there is no sharp distinction between genuinely cognitive questions and merely pragmatic ones. So, according to Quine, what Carnap takes to be internal questions are as pragmatic as
what it takes to be legitimate external questions.
So here comes Quine's pragmatism. And Q2, Carnap is right that we cannot ask such questions as, are there really sense, or are there really meanings? But this is not because they are inter-framework questions. I mean, this is how Carnap thinks, but Quine disagrees. But simply because they are supposedly framework independent. I mean, for Quine, this means simply metaphysical or a priori. So they are supposedly framework independent questions for Quine. And Quine insists that there are no such questions. So here comes Quine's metaphysical qualitism.
Now, Q3 is important.
However, for Quine, given the fundamental status of natural science, from the very perspective of natural science, it is still scientifically legitimate to ask some of Carnap's supposedly meaningless inter-framework ontological questions. I mean, from that perspective, from the perspective of natural science. So for Quine, it is scientifically legitimate to ask questions such as, are there sets from the perspective of natural science? I mean, although it is senseless to ask whether there are sets, absolutely, period, it does make sense for Quine to ask whether there are sets from the perspective of natural science, or are there meanings from the perspective of natural science. So here comes Quine's scientific foundationalism. I'd like to make two further comments on Quine. Before I do that, this is a very important part. I almost escaped it. Okay, now, what would Quine say about the supervenient thesis? I think Quine would have no problem accepting the supervenient thesis, as long as it can be understood as a scientific hypothesis, on a par with, say, the hypothesis that the temperature of gas is reducible to the average kinetic energy of the gas particles. And indeed, the following quote suggests that Quine does accept the supervenient thesis as a scientific hypothesis, which has been well confirmed and is implicitly adopted in all scientific inquiries. Well, this quote is very crucial for my purpose. This is from Quine's paper, review of Goodman's Ways of World Making. Okay, why, Goodman asks, this special deference to physical theory? I mean, Goodman cannot but ask this question because for him, every world version is on the same status, right? There's nothing privileged about physical world version. And then Quine answers, this is a good question. For Quine, this means that this is a scientific question, right? This is not a metaphysical question. And part of its merit is that it admits of a good answer. Again, it admits of a scientific answer. And then here comes the crucial part. Quine claims, nothing happens in the world, not the flutter of an eyelid, not the flicker of a thought, without some redistribution of microphysical states. Well, this is just the idea of the supervenient thesis, right? Quine claims that full coverage in this sense is the very business of physics and only of physics. Anyone who will say, here by anyone, Quine means any scientists. I mean, anyone, really, including any scientist, not just philosophers. So anyone who will say physics is all very well in its place, and who will not, is then already committed to a physicalism of at least the non-reductive, non-translational sort stated above. Hence my special difference to physical theory as a world vision, and to the physical world as the world. Okay, so now I would like to make two further comments on Quine. So first comment. Some philosophers, for example, Hukwei or Yablon, they suggest that there is an internal tension between Quine's metaphysical quietism and his physicalism. But as long as the former is a metaphysical quietism, while the latter comes from his scientific foundationalism, based on the supervenience as a scientific hypothesis, I do not see any tension here. And then the second comment is that, that said, I do have a reservation about Quine's apparent supposition that the supervenience thesis is a merely scientific hypothesis. For I think that it is in fact a substantial metaphysical thesis. If I am right, then Quine is after all not a metaphysical quietist, despite his aspiration to be so. So the question whether properties and facts posited by the frameworks of various natural sciences are supervenient upon those posited by the framework of physics, that is surely, I think, a scientific question. But on the other hand, I doubt that it is a scientific question to ask whether properties and facts posited by non-scientific frameworks are supervenient upon those posited by the framework of physics. So although I think that Quine's view is consistent, I have a doubt about its truth. Okay, so here comes finally Price. I summarized his position in four theses. So P1, Carnap is right in maintaining the sharp distinction between internal questions and external questions, although he's wrong to think that it is based on the distinction between genuine cognitive questions and merely pragmatic ones. Quine is right that internal and external questions are ultimately all pragmatic questions. So here comes Price's pragmatism. And this is two. Carnap is right that the distinction between internal questions and external questions depends on the distinction between intra-framework questions and inter-framework questions. And the latter distinction depends on irreducible functional differences among different frameworks. So here comes Price's functional pluralism. Now, P3. All legitimate inter-framework questions are questions about the difference in linguistic functions among the relevant frameworks and the roles of these different functions in our cognitive and practical lives. On the other hand, there are no genuinely inter-framework ontological questions. In this case, even from the perspective of natural science. So here comes Price's metaphysical and ontological quietism. And he is even higher than Quine, right? Now comes people. But Quine is right, though, that the framework of natural science and ultimately of physics occupies a privileged status among all linguistic frameworks. At least, I mean, that's how I take it to be his claim that framework of natural science has a perspectival privilege. So here comes Price's scientific naturalism. Okay, so here is my claim. I'm not sure whether Price can accept the supervenient thesis consistently with his functional pluralism. And here is the reason. So it seems that Price must accept the supervenient thesis in order to justify P4, namely scientific naturalism. But on the other hand, it follows from Price's functional pluralism that all inter-framework ontological questions are illegitimate ones. So for example, identity questions across functionally different frameworks are all pseudo-questions. I mean, although, of course, identity questions within the framework are perfectly good questions, as is illustrated in the following quote from Price. So Price claims, quote, "To ask whether an entity referred to in one framework is identical to an entity referred to in another framework seems to presuppose a framework independent stance from which the questions can be raised. If we reject the idea of such a stance, the upshot seems to be that identity claims such as Karl Marx is the father of Groucho Marx." I really like this statement. Karl Marx is the number three, go wrong in quite different ways. The first is false from within the framework in which we talk about persons. The second is not even false, it simply involves a category mistake. Okay, here comes a problem, at least as far as I can see. If identity questions do not make sense because of this reason, why can't we say the exactly same thing about supervenience? So, I mean, on the issues about supervenience, exactly inter-framework ontological questions. And if so, how could Price maintain that questions about identity are not legitimate questions, but that questions about supervenience are legitimate? So clearly, supervenience questions presuppose at least as much framework independent stance as identity questions do. So when you ask whether a set of properties supervene on another set of properties, I don't see why it is different from a question like a set of properties are identical with a set of another properties. I mean, as far as whether, I mean, concerning the question whether it is from the framework independent stance or not. All right. So I will now briefly summarize what I have argued so far.
Given Price's acceptance of the supervenience thesis, I think he is committed to a weak form of ontological foundationism.
But we have seen, I mean, if I'm right, that not only this commitment fails to dissolve all placement problems, it also seems inconsistent with Price's functional pluralism. Now, many of you might think, but then why can't Price just reject the supervenience thesis? I think that he cannot reject the supervenience thesis unless he gives up scientific naturalism. And here is an argument. Okay, given his scientific naturalism, Price cannot simply assume scientific naturalism without any scientific ground. He must provide a scientific reason for what allows us to legitimately investigate every linguistic framework from the framework of natural science, but not vice versa. But given Price's rejection of representationalism, the only way he can do this is by committing himself to some form of ontological foundationalism in a scientific version, a Lacanian. Well, again, I mean, Price might reply here that we could appeal to the notion of e-representation. I don't think that will really work. But there is also a separate issue. I mean, whether or not you can explain this fact by e, notion of e-representation, whether it is possible for anyone who accepts any sort of naturalism, and whether it is object naturalism or subject naturalism, to reject the supervenient thesis. I don't think that any naturalism in any form can reject the supervenient thesis. Okay, but the acceptance of the supervenient thesis is arguably the weakest form of ontological foundationalism, whether in scientific or in metaphysical judgment, such that one cannot accept any form of ontological foundationalism unless one accepts the supervenient thesis. Therefore, Price cannot reject the supervenient thesis unless he is willing to give up scientific naturalism. At least that's what I'm arguing. So now we finally reach the conclusion. If what I have said is right, then Price seems to be in a dilemma. So he must either embrace the supervenient thesis, which then implies that he will face some genuine placement problems, and also have a difficulty developing his functional pluralism in a consistent way. Or he must reject the supervenient thesis and hence reject all forms of ontological foundationalism, which then I think implies that he must give up scientific naturalism, I mean, even in the form of subject naturalism. I'd like to end with some further concluding remarks. If what I have argued in section 3 is right, then it shows that, I mean, Pacey Price, it shows that anti-representationalism alone cannot dissolve placement problems. It must be combined with anti-foundationalism, which requires the rejection of the supervenient thesis. I think, I mean, you can see this most clearly from the case of Quine. He denies representationalism, but he embraces foundationalism, I mean, in the sense of ontological foundationalism. And then, I mean, that enables him to accept the thesis of indeterminism of translation and inscrutability of reference. So, I mean, people like Rorty, this is a quote from Rorty's paper, Naturalism and Quietism. He says, interestingly, the quote, "Quietists think that no kind of thing is more fundamental than any other kind of thing." Well, I mean, this seems to imply that you must be an anti-foundationalist as well as an anti-representationalist to get conclusively out of all these placement problems. Okay, indeed I think that Price had better reject the supervenient thesis and thereby embrace anti-foundationalism in order to make his pluralistic naturalism more consistent. But this means that price should take the second one of the dilemma I formulated. That is to say, he should give up scientific naturalism. Because, I mean, from the perspective of scientific naturalism, I mean, whether it is in object form or subject form, it is really mysterious that if the supervenient thesis does not hold, right? I mean, which implies that every physical property remains and every physical fact remains in exactly the same, but still, I mean, there can be some changes, right, in other properties. I mean, how could you make sense of that once you accept scientific naturalism? Okay, so this means that Price should take the second horn of the dilemma I formulated, that is to say, he should give up scientific naturalism, even in the form of subjective naturalism, and accept more liberal naturalism. Okay, so that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.